This is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated August 31st. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Today's first article, Top of the Fold, North Carolina Income from Corporations on the Rise. By Lee Weisbecker, from Raleigh. State tax collections on corporate income, a key indicator of economic activity, rose by a healthy 12% in the fiscal year that ended June 30th. Companies paid $1.13 billion in state income tax during the 12 months, 36% more than in fiscal 2009, the bleakest year of the recession. The total for fiscal 2012 is still 22% below the $1.5 billion peak in fiscal 2007. North Carolina taxes corporations' net income at 6.9%. Higher collections reflect larger profits. The improved corporate performance is part and parcel of a gradual upswing in the state's economy, where there seems to be more positive news than negative released each month, General Assembly fiscal researcher Barry Boardman says. Yet, Boardman remains cautious about the overall direction of the state, saying in a May report that a slow growth scenario is expected to persist in 2013. Other economists, including North Carolina State University's Mike Walden, agree with that assessment. The corporate sector was clobbered during recession, and since then we've seen a major comeback, says Walden. We are out of the recession, but the pace of growth continues to be very, very slow. Walden compares the North Carolina economy to a swimmer treading water in his latest forecast issued the week of August 27th. Not sinking, but not impressing anybody with our Olympic-like performances either, he adds in an interview. I meant it mostly to describe the state's unemployment situation. UNC Charlotte economist John Connaughton, in his latest read on the Tar Heel economy, says he expects the state's gross domestic product to finish calendar year 2012 at $456 billion, up 3.8% from $439 billion in 2011. After adjusting for inflation, that's growth of about 2%, he says, modest performance at best. While the state has been in recovery since July of 2009, it has been a weak recovery, Connaughton says. In addition to tracking amounts of corporate taxes that flow into state coffers, the North Carolina Department of Revenue also studies the amounts paid in by various corporate sectors. In the 2009 tax year, the latest for which data are available, manufacturing firms accounted for nearly 12% of the 21,800 corporate tax returns, but paid a whopping 35% of the $911 million total collected that year. Professional, technical, and scientific companies accounted for 13% of the returns, but just 7.6% of the corporate income taxes paid. Real estate concerns, meanwhile, accounted for 3.2% of all corporate income taxes paid. Continuing on the front page, local hospitals face penalties for readmissions, by Jason DeBrune, from Durham. Top leadership at some Triangle hospitals spend a lot of time thinking about how to cut down on readmission rates, and two of those hospitals will open separate on-campus clinics to reduce the rate. In October, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services will begin penalizing hospitals that readmit patients within 30 days of discharge. To reduce readmissions and sidestep the penalty, the Duke University Health System and Rex Healthcare will soon open day clinics and encourage patients who come back to the hospital to go there instead of being technically admitted to the hospital. At first blush, the penalties might not appear that huge. Indeed, the maximum penalty is 1% of Medicare reimbursements. However, when considered that Medicare accounts for roughly one-third of a hospital's budget, the penalties can come to hundreds of thousands or even millions of dollars. It's a big topic nationally, says Dr. Lisa Clark-Pickett, the chief medical officer of Duke University Hospital. It's something we talk about every day. We've put a lot of work into readmissions, says Dr. Linda Butler, chief medical officer for Rex Healthcare, the Raleigh hospital owned by UNC Healthcare. These clinics would not require a large investment, nor would they necessitate approval by the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services. Hospitals hope to use these clinics as ways to educate patients on how to properly take care of themselves at home. As part of its efforts to bring down the cost of health care, the government is using the readmission penalty to encourage hospitals to take more responsibility for patients after they leave the hospital campus. Nearly 2 million Medicare beneficiaries nationwide are readmitted within 30 days of release each year, costing Medicare $17.5 billion in additional hospital bills, reports Kaiser Health News, which follows closely national health care policy. Combined, CMS hopes to recoup $280 million from the penalties in the coming year, but more importantly, hopes to cut down on the spending for readmissions. Hospital leaders agree that a more coordinated approach is needed, particularly at transition points between hospitals, primary care, and specialists, but that these penalties do nothing to hold the patient accountable. Hospitals often blame patients for coming back because they didn't schedule a follow-up doctor visit, didn't take their medications properly, or didn't make the lifestyle changes necessary to stay healthy. Some of it we do on our own, says Butler, but goes on to point out myriad scenarios in which a patient will come back to the hospital and the hospital did everything right. The question is, which one of the links in the chain will break, he says. To do their part, hospitals are now hiring nurses whose sole responsibility is to follow up with patients to make sure they are doing what the doctor ordered. Also, hospitals are now scheduling the first follow-up visit with a primary care doctor on behalf of the patient and doing everything in their power to make sure patients actually make the visit. Wake Med Health and Hospitals does not have plans to establish a new clinic focused on readmissions, but is working to improve the discharge process so patients leave the hospital better educated, says Becky Andrews, Wake Med Vice President of Health Information and Utilization Management. She agrees that penalties hit hospitals hardest. If there was a way to adjust the penalty based on what the hospital does, that would be much more fair, she says. While the concept is good for overall health care, the way the penalties are being assessed is more punitive on the hospital. And now, today's lead article, Bargain Land. Lot prices at Chapel Ridge have lost most of their value. By Amanda Jones Hoyle, from Pittsburgh. Near the peak of the real estate bubble, Tom O'Leary bought a vacant tree-lined lot in the Chapel Ridge golf course community and planned to build a home for his family there. Hundreds of other families and real estate investors from 34 states and even foreign countries were doing the same thing. They were lining up to buy lots in Chapel Ridge for an average of $134,000, more or less depending on the lot's views of the course designed by professional golfer Fred Couples. Now, instead of looking at home designs, O'Leary is looking for future investment deals in Chapel Ridge. Lot prices have fallen by more than 75% in the last 4 years. In July, O'Leary purchased the lot next to his on Cabin Creek for $15,000 after the bank foreclosed on his neighbor. The price was less than one-fifth what he paid for a similarly sized lot in 2006. We're actually negotiating to buy two more lots out there, he says. For the price, you can't beat it. Since 2008, at least 57 homes and lots within the Chapel Ridge golf community have gone into foreclosure, according to data collected by SiteTech Systems, a Myrtle Beach research and analysis firm that tracks real estate property records in the Carolinas. Another six property owners in Chapel Ridge face the same fate. But this isn't just a story about another real estate development that went belly up when the housing market crashed in 2008. In most other distressed housing communities in the Triangle, the impact fell most heavily on lot developers and home builders who overbuilt and then fell into arrears with their lenders. At Chapel Ridge, the crash was much more personal. Most of the 700-plus lots sold between 2004 and 2007 went to buyers who planned to raise families there or build homes for their retirement years. They were drawn to the much-heralded golf club at Chapel Ridge, which was sold to a Virginia company in 2010 and is managed separately from the housing community. Chapel Ridge also has a 3,400-square-foot clubhouse for residents and a swim and tennis center, but only 145 homes have been built. While signs proclaim the future home of on remaining lots throughout the 1,000 acres, most are now hidden behind tall grass and weeds. The original developer of the community, Boca Raton, Florida-based Blue Green Corporation, sold all of its remaining ownership in 7 communities in Texas, Georgia, and North Carolina to South Star Communities of Coral Gables, Florida in May, including its last 84 lots at Chapel Ridge. Chatham County real estate records show South Star paid $1.9 million for the Chapel Ridge property, or about $22,500 for each lot. Most of those 84 are among Chapel Ridge's larger lots of an acre or more. Most are attracting buyers pretty quickly, despite the distressed values of the foreclosed lots, says Will Johnson, president of Will Johnson Building Company in Chapel Hill, who also lives in Chapel Hill Ridge. It's not like there's no value there, he says, of the distressed lot sales. It's not like they are being dumped by the bank and nobody is taking them. While it hurts to have them as comps in the neighborhood, it's good to get them off the market. It's a double-edged sword. Chapel Ridge residents are also keeping a close eye on the private gated parks at Meadowview Community that adjoins Chapel Ridge. Crescent Resources of Charlotte began building the 793-acre parks at Meadowview Community in 2007, but suspended the project in 2009 when the company filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. Crescent Resources has since come out of bankruptcy, but has had little luck attracting a new buyer from Meadowview. It's been estimated that Crescent invested about $38 million in the project, including construction of the roads and other infrastructure in 576 home lots. Residents living in Chapel Ridge say they've become a much tighter-knit community because of the housing crisis. They believe their housing values will eventually rebound as long as the golf course is kept pristine. The community also continues to capture the attention of property owners like Derek Franchina, who built a home in Chapel Ridge in 2008, drawn to its proximity to his job in Chapel Hill and to family and friends living in Greensboro and in Pinehurst. Plus, its property owner association dues were reasonable, about $800 a year. Moreover, the community's covenants don't require a lot buyer to begin building by any particular date. They also allow property owners to choose their own builders. We fell in love with the community, Franchina says. It's a gorgeous area. And now, inside the front cover, DNC Impact Felt by Few in the Triangle, by Jason DeBruin, from Durham. The Democratic National Convention kicks into high gear this weekend, and it won't be a purely charlatan affair. Yes, it's in the Queen City. Yes, most of the $130 million in economic activity will happen there. But several Triangle area businesses expect to bring some of that revenue back home. One of the biggest is the Special Event Company, headquartered on T.W. Alexander Drive in Durham, which will host a flagship event at Discovery Place in the heart of downtown Charlotte. The DNC will hold 12 welcome events, for which it received a total of 166 bids. TSEC cut through and snagged one of the marquee events. We went through quite an extensive bid process, says Sally Webb Berry, the company's founder and CEO. That means other Triangle companies will benefit as well. Webb Berry says she has contracted with many of the Triangle area companies she regularly uses for catering, DJ, photography, and the like when she runs the show. That's been a really important thing for us so that all the revenue doesn't stay in Charlotte, she says in her distinctly British accent. Webb Berry is not disclosing the specifics of her contract. In all, she expects to take 40 people from the Triangle to Charlotte, but they didn't have to book a single hotel room. Everyone either has family, friends, or other acquaintances that will serve as host families. Of course, most of the economic impact will be closer to Charlotte, says Harvey Schmidt, president and CEO of the Greater Raleigh Chamber of Commerce. For us, it will be more episodic, Schmidt says. Schmidt and others on the chamber's executive staff discussed making a presence at the DNC, but decided against it. Folks in attendance are there for something unrelated to business as such, Schmidt says. There will be some branding for the state as a whole, but very little directly for Raleigh or Durham. David McLennan, a professor of political science at William Peace University in Raleigh, agrees that the economic impact for the Triangle will not be a tremendous amount. Seeing a teaching opportunity, however, he will take 7 students from William Peace University to the convention from Tuesday through Thursday to take in the goings-ons in real time. It's neat to go down there and have them see firsthand that it's not just the speeches at night, but a week in Charlotte of all kinds of things, he says. This will get them exposed to all the things that go on at a major political convention. Of course, the convention culminates in the nomination of a presidential candidate, but seeing the other speeches, rallies, meetings, delegates are just as important. Even the protests are good to see and aren't always televised, he says. These students are genuinely excited. Local politicians and Governor Beverly Perdue will attend the convention, as will local delegates, naturally. Continuing on, Medicaid fraud rampant across much of North Carolina. By Chris Bagley, from Raleigh. State and federal authorities are turning up ever larger numbers of Medicaid fraud in North Carolina as Medicaid rolls grow and new funding becomes available for investigation. The North Carolina Department of Justice is on track to win more than 30 convictions in the federal fiscal year that ends September 30th, the largest number since 2004. Court judgments connected to those in civil cases could top $70 million, by far the largest annual total in more than a decade. Numbers are rising in the Eastern District of North Carolina, U.S. Attorney Thomas Walker says, while declining to provide specific data. Nationally, federal prosecutors filed 52 charges of health care fraud in May, the latest month for which numbers are available, according to researchers at Syracuse University. It was the 4th most common type of white-collar charge, up from number 9 in May 2007. Medicaid is a joint federal-state program of medical funding for low-income people, and authorities decide to prosecute under state or federal statutes or both, based on a variety of factors. Common statutes include a state law specific to Medicaid provider fraud, which was expanded in 2009, and federal statutes on false statements, healthcare fraud, mail fraud, and wire fraud, North Carolina Department of Justice spokeswoman Noel Talley says. Also in 2009, the General Assembly passed a law modeled on the False Claims Act, first enacted by Congress in 1863. Like the federal law, the state law allows individual citizens to sue on the government's behalf in civil court and requires defendants to pay triple the proven damages. Walker and state prosecutors alike say expanded funding for investigations and prosecutions has helped fuel the increases in prosecutions. The state's Medicaid Investigations Division has grown to 59 positions from 34 in 2009, Talley says. Medicaid is only growing in size, and it makes sense that both federal and state governments would commit additional resources, says Josh Howard, who was chief of white-collar prosecution under Walker's predecessor and is now a white-collar defense attorney in Raleigh. North Carolina's pool of Medicaid clients has grown steadily in recent years, from about 1.2 million in 2006 to more than 1.6 million today, according to the North Carolina Department of Health and Human Services. Medicaid rolls could grow even more dramatically under the federal 2010 Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, referred to in some circles as Obamacare, depending on how the state implements Medicaid-related changes in the bill. States' programs can be covering adults without dependent children, for example. While the perpetrators are sometimes Medicaid recipients, health care providers account for most of the large cases that attract authorities' attention. In one typical case that the North Carolina Department of Justice filed in December, Raleigh area resident Andora Haley submitted timesheets to bill the Medicaid program for up to $25,000 for mental health services that she allegedly did not provide. Howard says many of the ruses involve false billing for services. Ambulances and other medical transportation are frequently involved, as are motor scooters billed to the program for Medicaid patients to get physician appointments, Howard says. Next up, Gridiron Rush. Football ticket sales brisk at NC State, while UNC struggles after NCAA sanctions. By Jason DeBrune, from Raleigh. Football ticket sales are lagging slightly at UNC Chapel Hill. While new athletic director Bubba Cunningham thinks that the lag has little to do with NCAA investigations into potential academic fraud in players' classes, he acknowledges that the resulting postseason ban may be a factor. At NC State, tickets are selling a bit faster than last year, when 96% of season tickets were sold by late August, says Chris Kensington, the executive senior associate athletics director there. With 3 weeks to go, it was only 150 tickets short of where it ended the season last year. So it's a good news story for us, Kingston says. UNC's athletics department has been under fire since the spring, when an NCAA investigation showed impermissible benefits for agents, as well as academic irregularities in the Afro-American Studies Department that inflated some football players' grades. The NCAA punished the school by cutting 15 scholarships over 3 academic years and banning the Tar Heels from postseason play this year. Still, people in North Carolina's college sports community say ticket sales probably weren't affected by those sanctions or even by subsequent findings that the academic improprieties probably dated back to the late 1990s. Studies of NCAA sanctions have been found that there was no relationship, either positive or negative, between NCAA penalties and outcomes like fundraising and attendance, says Chad McAvoy, a Syracuse University professor who studies collegiate ticket sales. McAvoy says formal studies are recent and few in number, but square with anecdotal evidence that he has seen. Most fans are more interested in seeing their teams win. A team's on-field performance will affect attendance far more than what happens in the classroom, he says. The economy still plays a role, too, particularly when it comes to selling the tickets allotted for visiting teams. East Carolina University and Virginia Tech did not take the full allotment of visiting tickets this year at UNC's Kenan Stadium. The Tar Heels hold 4,300 tickets for visiting teams, and both those universities had typically taken the full amount until this year. It's the economy, says Sandy Smith, who oversees ticket services at Virginia Tech in Blacksburg. The Hokies bought 3,000 tickets this year, leaving 1,300 available for single game purchases. The only opponent to take its full allotment of visiting team tickets in Chapel Hill this year was NC State. Smith says the cost of travel played a role, as did the fact that UNCCH classifies a Virginia Tech game as a premier, with tickets costing $60. A ticket to the game against Elon University, in contrast, cost $35. The game being on television also keeps people at home. To help boost sales, UNCCH offered a 3-game package for $135 this year, says Tim Sabo, director of ticket sales there. The university sold about 1,000 of those tickets, a modest but nice supplement, he says. As a private institution, Duke University withholds ticket sales figures. Continuing on, judges start to discharge suits filed by Florida resident. By Chris Bagley, from Raleigh. Judges have begun to throw out lawsuits that a disabled Florida resident filed against a series of retailers and restaurants in eastern North Carolina, saying that she doesn't visit them often enough to qualify as a legitimate plaintiff. Denise Payne and the National Alliance for Accessibility, a nonprofit organization that she runs near West Palm Beach, have filed dozens upon dozens of lawsuits under Title III of the Americans with Disabilities Act, which requires public places to make accommodations for disabled customers and visitors. Payne is listed as a plaintiff on at least 25 ADA lawsuits filed since January 2011 in U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of North Carolina. Several have recently been dismissed for lack of standing, including at least 4 since the beginning of August. Standing is a legal concept that requires a plaintiff to have a substantial connection to a case. Judges have ruled, sometimes in biting language, that Payne's connections to the businesses are too tenuous. In one recently dismissed case, Payne and her group had sued a Kentucky Fried Chicken franchise in Fayetteville. Ms. Bain lives more than 700 miles from the KFC restaurant at issue here, Judge Terrence Boyle wrote in dismissing the case on August 7th. Given the distance and the infrequency of her travel to the Fayetteville area, Ms. Payne has failed to establish a substantial likelihood of future harm. While other judges aren't compelled to follow Boyle's reasoning, it's possible that many of the 17 pending suits could be similarly dismissed. Remaining defendants include the Charlotte-based department store chain Belk Incorporated and AAC Investments Incorporated, a commercial landlord with office buildings in the Triangle and Charlotte. Several defendants have settled with Payne, her attorney Jacqueline London, and Owen Hardy, another London client who lives in Florida. Payne has cerebral palsy, a disorder of the nervous system that interferes with motor skills. Hardy is a gunshot victim and confined to a wheelchair. Randy Avram, an attorney with Kilpatrick Townsend in Raleigh who defends clients in ADA lawsuits, says he still would advise the Payne defendants to address the issues that London and her clients raised. It does a good job of stemming the tide with her as to the way she's doing business, Avram says of the rulings, but I think London is probably just going to round up a North Carolina resident to replace Payne as a plaintiff. Most of their lawsuits allege violations of measurable standards such as slopes of parking lots and distances in bathroom stalls. Like other Title III lawsuits, they seek court orders for the businesses to comply with the law rather than monetary compensation. Defense attorneys say compliance can cost anywhere from a few hundred to tens of thousands of dollars. Many of the settlements have also included modest legal fees, defense attorneys say. London declines to comment at length, citing the possibility that she may appeal one or more of the dismissals. Fayetteville attorney Lonnie Player says the settlements London suggested have been substantially larger than the cost of mounting a defense. Player represented defendants in three of the five cases that were dismissed. Representatives of Disability Rights North Carolina were not aware of London or the lawsuits she has recently filed on behalf of the clients, says Lisa Grafstein, an attorney with a Raleigh-based advocacy group. The group first contacts a business after determining that it's out of ADA compliance and files lawsuits only when the response falls short, Grafstein says. And now, Duke and Progress Energy, ready rate hikes for residential customers. By Chris Bagley. From Raleigh. North Carolina's two largest electrical utilities are gearing up for a series of rate increases even as they pass along savings that result from their recent merger. Representatives of both Progress Energy Carolinas and Duke Energy Carolinas say they plan to seek rate increases this fall to cover the cost of overhauling, upgrading, and converting power plants that serve customers in the state. Progress could make that request to the North Carolina Utilities Commission as soon as October, spokesman Mike Hughes says. It would be Progress's first general rate increase since 1988, shortly after the Sharon Harris nuclear plant went into service. The utility has regularly adjusted fuel surcharges in response to fluctuations in coal and natural gas prices. Residential hours has risen by 24% since 1991 to $105 compared to a 60% increase in a federal index that tracks electricity prices throughout the Southeast. Hughes says Progress, which serves Wake County and eastern areas of the state, hasn't decided how big of an increase to seek, but it could be large considering the scope of the costs it's designed to cover. The utility recently began a multi-year plan to spend hundreds of millions of dollars converting coal plants to run on natural gas, and it expects to spend a total of $1.5 billion on upgrades and special maintenance projects at the three nuclear plants in North Carolina and northeastern South Carolina between January 2012 and December 2014. We do expect to be seeking general rate increases more often, because we, like many utilities, are entering a building phase, Hughes says. Duke, meanwhile, has suggested that it will ask for increases in the range of about 10% for areas it serves between Durham and Hickory, says Robert Gruber, executive director of the Utilities Commission's public staff, which advocates on behalf of the state's ratepayers. In Duke's last general rate case, it initially requested a 15% rate hike, and eventually won an increase of 7.2%. North Carolina Attorney General Roy Cooper is asking for a smaller increase in an appeal pending before the North Carolina Supreme Court. Further clues may come in the next few weeks when the utilities are expected to file annual updates to their long-range plans to build and expand power plants. Those documents, known as integrated resource plans, can't be directly translated into rates, but they do shed light on the capital spending that rate increases are designed to cover. The two utilities merged their corporate structures on July 2nd, a move that executives said was aimed partly at limiting the scope of the coming rate hikes. Both cut rates slightly in August, citing better efficiency from increased buying power and fuel markets and from coordination of their generating fleets. Environmental and consumer advocate John Runkle says he believes Progress has waited 25 years for the broader rate review, in part because of a 12.75% maximum return that regulators approved for the utility in 1987. If Progress had been coming in more frequently for rate increases, they would have been making these kind of investments in plants, says Runkle, an attorney with the nonprofit North Carolina Waste Awareness and Reduction Network. Next up, arbiter ruling could help Salix's position against NAPO, by Jason DeBrun from Raleigh. A recent arbitration ruling between a drug developer and a drug manufacturer could bode well for Raleigh's Salix Pharmaceuticals. In the past months, Salix became locked in a nasty dispute with San Francisco partner NAPO Pharmaceuticals, which accuses Salix of dragging its feet and bringing a drug that NAPO licensed to Salix into market. NAPO sued Salix, arguing it wants the licensing contract terminated and have full rights to the drug called crofelemer back. NAPO had a similar complaint against a drug manufacturing company called Glenmark Pharmaceuticals based in Mumbai, India, with which NAPO hashed a similar licensing agreement in 2005 as it does with Salix, but for rights to different countries. In that case, an independent arbiter ruled against NAPO in August 2023, meaning Glenmark still has the rights to manufacture and sell crofelemer in 140 countries except in North America, Europe, or Japan, where Salix has exclusive rights. Crofelemer is not approved anywhere yet, but on September 5th, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration is scheduled to make a ruling on crofelemer to treat HIV-associated diarrhea, a market with 350,000 people in the United States, according to Lisa Conte, CEO of NAPO. Worldwide, 33 million people live with HIV, and roughly 90% of them suffer from chronic diarrhea, something crofelemer would treat. If approved, per the contract, Glenmark must seek approval to sell crofelemer around the world, as it is Salix's duty to seek approvals in Europe and Japan. To tell you the truth, we're quite confused and befuddled by the ruling, Conte says on August 24th. We are hopeful that now it's 7 years later and Glenmark has in hand the full NDA filing, that they will work with great tenacity to get this product on the market. Recently, Conte accused Salix not only of dragging its feet but in applying for crofelemer's approval, but also of not being ready to launch the product if it receives approval. She now says Salix might intentionally be delaying a launch in favor of developing its own drugs, which could potentially compete directly with crofelemer in the future. It's either a competence issue or there is a competitive situation, says Conte. Salix has called the accusations baseless and argues that any delays in launching crofelemer were only because it had to redo much of the work NAPO claimed to have done properly. As we have said consistently, NAPO's lawsuit is entirely without merit, wrote Salix spokesman Mike Freeman in an email. Salix has worked diligently to develop and commercialize crofelemer and will continue to do so. Headquartered in two large buildings on Six Forks Road in North Raleigh, Salix Pharmaceuticals is the Triangle's largest homegrown drug company. It primarily makes drugs that treat gastrointestinal diseases. For the first half of 2012, Salix reported $352 million in sales and $30 million in net income, driven largely by its leading drug, Xifaxan, which treats traveler's diarrhea and other gastrointestinal diseases. Xifaxan accounted for 65% of Salix's product revenue in the first half of the year. After a deal was struck in 2008, Napo licensed crofelemer, its leading product, to Salix in December 2008. In that deal, Salix paid Napo $5 million initially, agreed to pay Napo an additional $50 million if crofelemer is approved, and up to $250 million more depending on how well the drug sells. As part of that deal, it was Salix's responsibility to file for crofelemer's approval, but in Conte's opinion, Salix did not move ahead with the application quickly enough. On May 5th, 2011, Napo filed its lawsuit to terminate the deal and take crofelemer back. That lawsuit will likely not be resolved for months or even years. In response, Salix argues that crofelemer was far from being ready to submit for approval when Salix took over. Incomplete clinical reports and incorrectly analyzed data are just two of the counterclaims made by Salix. Considerable work remained to be done to ready crofelemer for regulatory review and approval, according to court documents filed by Salix. In addition to the redoing work, Salix ran a Phase 3 trial on crofelemer, a costly and time-consuming undertaking. Napo's claims hinge on several points, including that Salix wants to market Xifaxan to treat irritable bowel syndrome with diarrhea, an indication that Conte and Napo want for crofelemer as well. Salix would split revenue on sales of crofelemer, but not on sales of Xifaxan. Salix is conducting a Phase 3 study to determine its efficacy and safety of Xifaxan in treating IBS with diarrhea. Salix's leaders have been mostly mum about crofelemer for the past few months. On a conference call, CFO Adam Derbyshire said the company is optimistic on the response that's coming and that there has been quite a lot of activity in regard to crofelemer, but did not give specifics. Only one analyst on the call, Gregory Fraser of Bank of America Merrill Lynch, asked about the Napo suit and if Salix was indeed ready to launch crofelemer should the FDA approve it. In response, CEO Carolyn Logan said, "We're in just the early stages of discovery of the Napo suite. We still feel very confident about our ability to prevail in that, and if the drug is approved on September 5th, because there are HIV-positive and AIDS patients who desperately need this drug, we would make it available as soon as we possibly can for them. If we don't do a formal launch until our national sales meeting, which will be in late February in 2013, but certainly once the drug is approved, we would not withhold it from anyone." Conte, who listened in on the conference call, said it was heartbreaking when she heard Logan say that an official launch might not happen until February. At best, they could have drugs for maybe a couple thousand patients beginning September 6th, Conte estimates. Sales estimates for crofelemer range depending on who makes the estimate. Analysts for Zurich-based Credit Suisse and Baltimore-based Stifel Nicolaus, for example, project 2015 sales in the $75 million range, while those at New York-based Jefferies & Company and Goldman Sachs put sales around $25 million that year. Sales for crofelemer could increase depending on future approvals. And now, Lenovo EMC Venture offers promise for tech area ops. By Lauren K. Alsange, from Durham. Chinese computer company Lenovo, already nipping on the heels of number one HP in the consumer market, is setting its sights on capturing more of the business or the enterprise market. Lenovo's leaders say the effort is strengthened by a recently announced partnership with Boston-based EMC. Both companies have operations in the Triangle. David Schmock, head of North American operations for Lenovo, says the partnership will allow the company to add storage to its IT portfolio. "Now we have a nice end-to-end solution," he says, "one that could someday lead to IT bundles, such as Dallas, Texas-based VCE's V-Block that incorporates products from Cisco, EMC, and VMware in one IT package." The partnership will allow for joint development between the companies, making servers better, Schmuck says, adding that servers could be embedded into EMC storage products. "We have to earn our right to be in the data center," Schmuck says. "We're laying a great foundation today." Enterprise works differently than the consumer market in which Lenovo has found comfort, Schmock says. It's not necessarily about cost or gimmicks. It's about credibility. I have to earn the right to get into a CIO's office, he says. It's a journey. It takes a little time, and this partnership will facilitate that. Currently, he adds, Enterprise makes about 10% of Lenovo's revenue, which tops about $8 billion annually. He hopes to up that to 25%. I'm an aggressive guy, and I always like it sooner than later, but it's a multi-year journey, he says. Lenovo moved into the partnership with EMC after Dell started to develop competing products and pulled out. Schmuck says he jumped at the opportunity when he first heard about it last fall. The RTP location of EMC, coupled with Lenovo's Morrisville presence, makes integration easier. Malanka Munki, a representative of Lenovo, says the company is expanding its technical expertise in RTP to help drive its server storage business. Its recent addition of a third building in its office complex shows the company's commitment to the area, she says. If Lenovo can have success in enterprise similar to what it's had in the PC market, major new revenue could be created. Gartner analyst Mikiko Kitagawa says Lenovo is one of the few PC makers with solid growth in the market, a market she says is struggling overall. It's close to being number one vendor, she says, noting the market share difference between Lenovo is less than 1%, calling it a virtual tie. Schmuck says the Lenovo team will continue in the PC push and that enterprise revenues are just another way to add to what the Chinese company with U.S. headquarters and RTP is already doing. Lenovo is contributing cash to the venture while EMC is delivering assets. Joe Tucci, chairman and CEO of EMC, says the partnership will help EMC expand its presence in China. And now, money matters. Change in strategy. Bound Incorporated wants to generate buzz through social networks. By Cameron Snipes. From Durham. Bound Incorporated, a custom journal maker based in Durham, has recorded a steady performance since its founding based on examinations of its financial statements for the year. With further inspection of the spinning cogs within suggests that the company's operations have been far from steady. Triangle Business Journal has chronicled Bound and moves by its founding trio over the past 12 months. One of those changes, co-founder David Faber, the company's tech expert and only full-time employee, moved back home to California near the beginning of 2012. With that, he ceased to be full-time with the company, though he still maintains its information technology infrastructure from the West Coast. Bound underwent several other changes in its quest to become a full-fledged entity. Today, Bound has about $23,000 in the bank and a growing list of potential customers. But this year, the company faced some major obstacles to execute its initial business plan. In March, the company lost its key supplier, Greeting Express, when that Durham-based company got out of the bookbinding business. Bound found a new partner in laser image printing and marketing just a few doors down from Greeting Express. Though orders weren't interrupted, it was an abrupt change, and the team spent a few harried weeks making sure the transition was a smooth one. The next big operational change? CEO Joel Sadler quit his day job, moved to Paris with his wife, and yet dedicated himself full-time to Bound. Sadler says he will receive a salary of $2,500 per month starting in September. Sadler's visa is for 12 months with the option of renewal. After that, he'll most likely be back in Durham, but regardless of geography, he says he'll be doing Bound full-time until the wheels fall off. Bound now stands as a company that operates with founders in three different time zones. The third, David's brother, Michael Faber, remains in Durham. Michael Faber acknowledges challenges, but he says that operations have gone fairly smoothly and that communication hasn't been much of an issue, since most of their correspondence is carried out through email. We found that 3 p.m. Eastern time on Sundays is the optimal time for us to actually talk to each other about the business, Michael Faber says, adding that communication issues haven't kept any time-critical elements from being resolved. Fast forward to late August, Michael Faber says the orders for journals are still coming in steadily. Bound now averages 5 to 7 orders a day through its website and a few bulk orders per month. The company considers a bulk order to be more than 10 journals or memo books. Going after more bulk orders was the main growth strategy for Bound. Not anymore. Michael says that the new marketing push will focus on advertising on social networking sites such as Twitter and Facebook. We're looking at getting more people to engage with us, Michael Faber says. We think that's much more meaningful as a marketing strategy. We're looking at less big splash, more frequent low-impact stuff. During a recent three-way telephone conversation, the founders shared their State of the Union, in which they laid out bullet points for where they were and plans for success going forward. First was, hooray, we made it, Michael Faber says. The next two items on the list, year one, building and laying the groundwork, year two, ramping up and stepping on the gas. But to do that, Bound's founders have to be able to put their ideas into useful practice. Michael Faber says, we need to be able to work on the business all day, he says. To do that, Michael estimates that Bound will have to increase its daily orders three or fourfold, and they are counting on the new social network advertising push to lead them in the right direction. The outcome will decide whether Bound is to be written off as a hobby that was once fun to share, or whether it flourishes into a legitimate Bull City business. And this week's opinion page includes articles from guest columnist Mr. Andrew Broad. Mr. Broad is a senior research fellow at UNCG's Center for Business and Economic Research. Therefore, it makes little sense for our system of sales taxes to give an advantage to online shopping, even a slight one, especially when doing so deprives states of tax revenues they would otherwise collect. The success of e-commerce should be based on its pricing and convenience, not its ability to evade sales tax. The proposed legislation is not without opposition. Some conservatives object to it because they see it as a tax increase rather than a mechanism to collect existing taxes. Others go beyond anti-tax principles and claim that the increase in taxes paid will discourage consumer spending, which is hardly what the economy needs. However, the small incentive effect of sales tax makes it highly unlikely that consumers will spend noticeably less. For example, the Tax Foundation has found that sales tax holidays, which serve as a kind of natural experiment by temporarily eliminating sales tax, change the timing of consumer spending, but not the amount. Moreover, while online purchases have increased steadily as a share of all retail sales, e-commerce still accounts for only about 5% of retail purchases. Even if sales taxes had a strong incentive effect, the overall effect of collecting sales tax for online purchases would be diluted by a factor of 20. Finally, some opponents argue that remote retailers shouldn't pay sales tax because they don't impose cost on their customer states. But roads are driven on when merchandise is delivered, regardless of who sold it. Most of sales taxes are structured so the delivery location determines the applicable tax rate. In North Carolina, for example, a Greensboro company that makes a delivery to a Charlotte customer must collect the Mecklenburg tax rate. The proposed legislation allows small online retailers to continue evading sales tax, state sales tax, which makes this little sense. Are small online retailers more deserving of this exception than small bricks and mortar stores? A better solution would be to include small online retailers, but do so gradually. Online retailers have gotten a break for 20 years. It's time for them to pay their taxes like everyone else. This week's second guest column is by Ms. Molly Hedgman. Ms. Hedgman is the Director of Human Resources for Capital Associated Industries in Raleigh. Benefits help retention and recruitment. Though the overall economy remains sluggish, most of the Triangle's job market is faring relatively well. The most recent unemployment levels received in July 2012 for Wake, Durham, Orange, and Johnston and Chatham counties hovers around 8%, well under the state average of 9.8%. For employers, this data serves as an encouraging yet challenging news. With the job market expanding in the area, the best candidates realize how competitive the Triangle market is filling positions, and they are able to be more selective when deciding between various job offers. This is occurring partially through the work in the Triangle Regional Talent Attraction Initiative, led by Wake County Economic Development, that aims to connect and recruit top talent with employers and job opportunities in key industry clusters of the Triangle area of North Carolina. These new circumstances are generating more emphasis for employers on positioning areas such as compensation, benefits, work-life balance, and integrated total rewards as absolutely essential elements for attracting top candidates. It is important for organizations to increase the reach of their employee benefits and rewards in order to be more effectively address the needs of employees as well as attract top candidates. More specifically, a more expansive reward strategy, including base and bonus pay, benefits package, work environments, and company culture, can support overall business goals. The importance of implementing the strategy appeared in the latest CAI Policies and Benefits Survey released in June, a statewide review conducted earlier this year that covers the key components of human resource policies, employee benefits, and the leading trends in today's workforce. In the survey, 44% of respondents from across North Carolina indicated they offered some form of alternative work schedules to their employees, including a compressed work week, the ability to work remotely, and flexible scheduling. With such a substantial amount of participants already in play, an organization lacking a fresh and expansive benefits program can find itself losing the best candidates to its competition due to its failure to meet the expectations for excellence in a crowded job market. Human resource professionals, senior executives, and business owners in all sizes of every industry should understand that a rewards program goes beyond simply offering a competitive salary and basic benefits. Employees are considering the overall value proposition that a company offers, including wellness initiatives, social outreach, career development, recognition of performance, and alternative work schedules. These concerns reflect the sophistication of the workforce over the past decade. Employees are more selective when making decisions regarding potential employment, as they place a greater significance on implementing a proper work-life balance. Some businesses already have structured themselves in a way that puts a reward strategy in place without formally recognizing it as such. Ones that do address pertinent issues of employee concerns, such as multi-generational retirement planning, rewards and recognition, career and professional development, and a flexible scheduling. Motivation through awards is the approach for the future of doing business in North Carolina, particularly in the Triangle. Companies that effectively motivate their employees by expanding the benefits offered to them will maximize their capability to recruit and continue to engage top talent. When this system is in place by a majority of organizations, it will help strengthen and grow North Carolina businesses into competitive leaders internationally. 5-year-old Durham Clothier Schoolhouse LLC is raising $550,000 in debt financing. The company has already raised $125,000 in the round, and 11 investors have participated, according to the filing. The company, which lists Bull City Forward's Chris Gergen as a director, is fronted by CEO Rachel Weeks. This round is in addition to the $1.3 million in equity sold to investors in April. Weeks did not return calls seeking comment. In 2011, the Collegiate Apparel Company made headlines when it relocated its manufacturing facility from Sri Lanka to Wendell in what was referred to as inshoring. Garner native and American Idol winner Scotty McCreery is slated to perform at the 2012 Gildan AAA National Championship game at the Durham Bulls Athletic Park on September 18th. McCreery will throw out the game's first pitch and perform Take Me Out to the Ball Game during the seventh inning stretch. McCreery, who was crowned the winner of the 10th season of American Idol in 2011, is no stranger to baseball diamonds. While at Garner High School, he was a member of the baseball team. It's not usually news when a city disposes of surplus property, but in this case, with the town of Pittsburgh, it is, because the surplus property is a dog. That property is Kilo, the Pittsburgh Police Department's drug-sniffing German Shepherd. Turns out the PPD can't find anyone to handle Kilo, so they're looking for another law enforcement agency to buy the pooch, or, if that doesn't happen, sell him at auction. Kilo has been a member of the town's police force for 2 years. His first handler left the department after 6 months. A second handler got certified and worked with Kilo for 10 months, but asked out of the duty. Then, number three did the same after 7 months, according to the report in the Chatham News. Apparently, handling Kilo is a big job. The dog lives with the handler and goes on duty with him or her. After a recent conversation with new UNC Chapel Hill athletics director Bubba Cunningham, the biz for Triangle Business Journal wondered whatever happened to Dick Bedour, the former athletics director who retired amid NCAA investigations into academic improprieties. Well, the TBJ found out, and it seems that Bedour didn't go very far. A university spokesman confirmed that Bedour plans to serve as a guest speaker in classes this fall if he's asked to do so by faculty members. He would not receive a salary for any such appearances. The spring semester might be a different story, however. It's possible he will teach a seminar in 2013, but those details are not yet clear. It appears that TBJ was one of the few in Raleigh to actually watch the Olympics this summer. The Sports Business Daily, a sister publication, compiled Nielsen television ratings of NBC's primetime coverage that showed the Raleigh-Durham market ranked 55th out of 56 markets, with a 14.9% rating. The only city lower on the list was Charlotte. Apparently, its 13.9 rating shows that North Carolinians didn't care about the Olympics, at least not in prime time, as much as other areas did, despite the fact that athletes from the Tar Heel State won 19 total medals in London. That would have ranked us 13th in the world compared with other countries. Salt Lake City finished with the highest rating, a 25, according to Nielsen. We've run out of time for this week's edition of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program will be available online at trianglereadingservice.org immediately after the broadcast. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.